Hello, welcome to Law Matters. Thank you. My guest today is Jonathan Kaplan, KC, formerly QC, and of course, he's no stranger to Hong Kong. He's been here on many occasions, working very often on behalf of defendants, and from time to time also prosecuting on behalf of the Hong Kong government. Jonathan, good morning.
Morning, Jonathan.
Yes, we're going to have some difficulty distinguishing ourselves by names, but hopefully voices will tell the truth. Thank you so much for coming by and for joining in at one of our series of Haldane's podcasts. And I'm particularly pleased to welcome you because not only have you been a great colleague over the years and we've shared many cases, but also that we've had a long friendship. So we'll put that one up front. And so it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
And we met yesterday, of course, and discussed a little bit about what we might talk about that was entertaining, we hope, not only to lawyers, but to a wider public, because Haldane's finds at his podcast that there are people outside the law that tune in. So can I just start by reminding you, if you've already forgotten, and it's a long time ago, so you might have done, that you first came here and represented a client for us, actually, and when I say us, it's Haldane's, in 1993?
That's right. 40 years ago. No, 30 years ago, sorry.
Maths was never your strength. It's always been law. Yeah, it's 30 years ago that you've been coming to Hong Kong and representing clients. And I thought it... And by the way, you were actually advising clients in the 1980s.
Yes, I did come to Hong Kong in the 1980s with a client from London. I was a junior barrister, so you couldn't obviously be admitted to practice in the courts here. But I've always had a love for Asia. And I think I caught the Hong Kong bug then in about 1986 when I came over with the client in that case. He was represented by a very distinguished English QC who sadly is no longer with us, John Matthew.
Yeah.
And that's when I first met you.
Yeah. Yes, John was, of course, he was instrumental in many of our cases together. And some have, and I'm among them, have described him as the finest advocate probably in the Commonwealth in the last 100 years.
Yes, I would say that's true. And, of course, he's rivaled very closely by Sidney Kentridge, who is a South African advocate. Many people will know, represented Nelson Mandela, then came to have a very successful career in London. But I think those two are probably the finest advocates from England, certainly in the last 50 plus years.
And it's fair to say, and I know you'll blush at this, but of course you took up the mantle to some extent. You, first of all, you became joint head of chambers after John retired.
Yes.
And you have represented many clients on behalf of many different law firms, including Haldane's. And indeed, you've prosecuted as well for the Hong Kong government.
Yes, I have. And both have been very fascinating experiences, which maybe we'll touch on in a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, why don't you touch on it now, actually? Let's go back to 1993. Why don't you talk a little bit about the start of it all and entertain us by just giving a potted history through what we call the handover, of course, 1997, and then through to today. I mean, what just chat for a couple of minutes about that. Let's hear about it.
Well, I mean, it's always a privilege to leave England and go and work in somebody else's
back garden. Yes.
And I think it's the premise is that you are invited because, in theory, you have something to offer, and hopefully we do, to the local legal system. But, of course, you gain a lot as well. And coming in 1993 to Hong Kong, which was still very firmly then in British rule, it was a very vibrant, I made the beginning of many, many friends who have really been, for me, almost another life. So every time I'm back to Hong Kong, I'm stepping into another world with friends I've known for many years. I think the period up to handover, and I came here a few times in the legal system, was very much very English, obviously. And I think we all expected in 1997, when I say we, I mean those of us who were lucky enough to come from England to practice here, that the golden egg in coming to Hong Kong probably was over and that things would change. But I have to say, from 1997 onwards, post-handover, I was fortunate enough to come here on many occasions since then, both for defendants acting privately and for the government. And I must say, the things hadn't changed. If anything, I'd say they'd improved. I think the judiciary was, if I may say so, I think probably improved. I think the cases were continually fascinating. Cases which you couldn't really imagine on their facts. Some of them just so unreal.
You'll make a good book or a film one day.
Yes. I mean, there is certainly a number of Hollywood A-list films out of certainly half a dozen of the cases I've been in. We British barristers came here and I think were welcomed. And the success rate, I would say, of applying to come here, because as you know, we don't have a right to be here to practice. We apply on a case-by-case basis, and it's for the Secretary for Justice and the courts to decide, and the Bar Council, whether or not the case merits the attendance of an English QC, now KC. I think they were very generous in admitting us, and I would say something like 60% of applications from English counsel, senior counsel to come here, were admitted. And the work was fascinating. And I would say, I'm now talking about the period up until 2020, that Hong Kong, as a leading international financial centre, was highly regarded around the world for the quality of its judiciary, for the impartiality of its legal system, and for the strength of the local bar and visiting advocates. And I think people felt it was an excellent legal system. Now, we know since then there's been a lot of international coverage of Hong Kong, and there's various political views you can take one way or the other. I'm not certainly engaging in that. But clearly, it has been under strain, I would say, for the last 2 years.
Or slightly longer, because, of course, it all started with what we're going to call social unrest, because it's the easiest way of describing what happened, when there was violence on the streets for a period of time. That's more than 2 years ago now.
Yes.
It's pre-COVID. We've had a double whammy here.
Yes.
We had the social unrest and then the COVID. And it seemed to me, when I was thinking about this, there are two touchstones to the whole thing. There was the what I call the David Perry incident. Do you remember that?
Very well.
And then more recently, and indeed current, the Tim Owen issue.
Yes.
Should we just mention for a moment the David Perry incident?
Yes.
Because it was longer ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's put that in context.
So David Perry is a very experienced counsel, very highly regarded in the UK and here in Hong Kong, who appears in other jurisdictions as well. And he's acted in a number of big cases for the Department of Justice.
Mm. It would be true to say he's prosecuted more than defended.
Yes.
Although we've actually instructed him to defend as well.
He's very capable. I think he's known for prosecuting in big cases and for his legal capabilities in appellate courts. And he was instructed to, on behalf of the Department of Justice, in a case of unlawful assembly, I think under the public order ordinance, to prosecute Jimmy Lai and I think eight others over an allegation of unlawful assembly during the demonstrations.
Mm.
And what then happened was that there was tremendous amount of domestic criticism, both politically and in the media, that he had accepted the brief.
Now, when you say domestically, you're talking about the English perspective.
Yes.
The criticism came from London.
Yes.
Yep.
The consequence of that is that he withdrew, and he'd been approved, been sought out by the Department of Justice. The High Court had approved him coming, and it felt that he had something to add on the constitutional aspects of the offence. And it was very important to understand what the limits of that offence were, what the defences properly were, and they wanted his assistance. Now, I am going to make a little comment here. It's about our own politicians. We suffer, and this is obviously my personal view at the moment, from politicians, I'm afraid, certainly the current batch, who are very keen to pronounce, but who have very little practical experience of Asia. And if I'm going to single two out, I'll single out Dominic Raab, who was then the Foreign Secretary.
Yes.
Lynn Truss. There are others who clearly have been very vocal in these arguments. But Dominic Raab made, I think, a totally unfounded and, I would say, libelous allegation against
him. And wrong on the facts, by the way, because he got the wrong charging
system. Yeah, she said that he was prosecuting under the National Security Law.
Yeah.
But he accused David Perry actually of being mercenary in wanting to do this case, which, if you know him, is
the reverse of what
the
he
reverse.
Is.
He's really totally interested in the law.
Yeah.
But it's an indicator of the way in which Hong Kong and China have become a flashpoint in the Western media for concerns about human rights and democracy. Now, again, I'm not going to get into the rights and wrongs of the coverage of the demonstrations in Hong Kong. Again, there's a debate you could have separately about that. But certainly the coverage was very one-sided, I think, in the Western press about those demonstrations, which in many instances were extremely violent.
Correct. And you might recall, I'm sure you do, that Haldane's actually put on a webinar where we invited Lord Faulkner. And
yes.
The previous Chief Justice, Honourable Geoffrey Marr, and others, and including yourself.
Yeah.
And we debated the whole issue because we at Haldane's, and I personally, thought it was an extremely important issue and very detrimental to the people of Hong Kong.
Yes.
That uninformed people like Dominic Raab would get both the facts wrong and the tone wrong and fundamentally strong-arm David Perry out of the case.
Yes. Well, he withdrew, and it's very unfortunate that he withdrew, because in my view, some people say he should never accept the brief. I do not accept that. I think as a barrister, unless there are very potent reasons of conflict or some other exceptional reason, if you're asked to do a case, his legal contribution would have been great assistance both to the prosecution and the defence, I would say.
And very balanced.
Yeah, but in any event, he withdrew. I think there's another factor was, obviously, the question of quarantine and whether he would have made the case or not. But very unfortunate that that happened. But that undoubtedly was the catalyst, I think, for people saying, do we really continue to need or want and should we continue to instruct and or accept the brief in cases in Hong Kong? And that became a much broader debate,
yeah.
Whereas this was a case that was concerned very much with a political demonstration.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you rightly said, there's another case which followed very closely about 2 years later, 18 months later, the case of Timothy Owen, who this time was instructed in a case involving Jimmy Lai, but not for the prosecution, for the defence, and this time under the national security law. And again, that instruction of English, this time KC, because our Queen sadly died last September, was approved by the High Court and by the Court of Final Appeal. So both courts and the highest court in Hong Kong felt that it was an appropriate case under the law for an English senior counsel to come in and to deal with any constitutional arguments that there may be. And as we know, that in turn resulted in objections, not this time from the prosecution's Department of Justice
in Hong Kong
and from the Hong Kong executive.
Yeah, and not as far as I could tell from Beijing, this seems to be a Hong Kong triggered objection.
Yes, there was no, as far as I'm aware, there's no opinion from Beijing at that time. There might have been subsequently, I don't know.
But the chief executive referred it to Beijing and said, will you consider the matter?
Yes.
Please? Yeah.
And I think this raises a host of very interesting and important issues. First of all, obviously the name of the general law is the National Security Law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that can cover a variety of things. There's a separate official secrets ordinance here, I believe, in any event. But national security can involve encouraging acts which are contrary to public order, encouraging people to support independence of Hong Kong from the People's Republic of China. It doesn't necessarily involve state secrets.
Yeah.
My understanding is in this case, and it's only an understanding, there are no state secrets. And I understand the evidence is very largely what was published by Apple and what, whether or not he was colluding with foreign powers and foreign interests.
So fairly narrow.
Very narrow.
The case against Mr. Lai, as we understand it.
Yes, I don't understand this as a case that's going to be sitting in closed court where there will be secrets. In any event, I think you've got to remember that under the National Security Law, and it's Article 63, there is a statutory duty on prosecution and defence counsel to maintain confidentiality about whatever they learn. So that's already in the National Security Law. So, I mean, one wonders, what is the objection here, actually? Is it that he's going to be apprised of state secrets? I don't think so. Is it that he's not sufficiently versed in the local culture or perspectives to be able to add value to the themes that are embraced by the National Security Law? Is that a valid argument? Or what is it? Hasn't actually been stated.
No.
I've read various people saying that it would be wrong to trust foreigners with cases of matters there and facts that they may learn under this case. But that might be true in state secrets. Mm. It's not true in every national security case under the under the law. So, I mean, I think it's very important somebody needs to decide and formulate what are the objections to him or other counsel doing this case. Then I think you obviously need to consider, look at what a national security involves. I would readily accept that in most jurisdictions, if there is a genuine national security element, then the procedures change. For example, if it's a national security case involving top secret material, courts are closed for large parts of the trial. There are certain conditions under which you can receive the material. And in some jurisdictions, only certain people can act in the case. I accept that.
Yeah, that would be true. If I can interrupt for a moment, that's true in some instances, for example, in England.
It's true in terrorist cases where people have appointed for them, where they're in custody, an advocate who is independent, but who's been vetted to be able to see the material from the intelligence services. There are many trials, criminal trials, however, where the state has no control over who the defence advocate is.
They may not like it, but they get it.
You know, they just have to find ways of dealing with it.
Who does the vetting in the instance?
In the case where you're dealing with terrorism and people who are detained under the terrorism legislation, that is done by the security services.
So it's a non-judicial
There's a high court judge. It's a non-judicial filter. And there's a high court judge, independent counsel appointed on his behalf. And you get to see the material, but you're vetted before you see it.
I see. So what we're saying is it's not unique for jurisdictions to place unusual restrictions, like, for example, determining who can and cannot act for a defendant in certain types of cases.
In certain types of cases. Yeah. Indeed, many years ago, I did the most bizarre case in England, which did involve national security. It was for a journalist called Mark Hosenball, who, together with another person, was the first person to reveal an article in Time Out magazine about signals intelligence, the NSA in America and GCHQ, and they never want to be put above the ground. But he did. Yeah. He was told he was going to be kicked out. Well, he wasn't told why. And we were told we could appear in front of a panel of three men called the Three Wise Men. They wouldn't tell us what the allegations were. We weren't going to be given any papers and we could say whatever we liked. I mean, it was Alice in Wonderland.
You talked about football.
That was all on the basis of national security.
Mm.
So yes, of course, it can change things.
Mm.
But I think you've really got to be sure that you are dealing with national security and you're not dealing with people who are simply being charged with promulgating views that are not very, very well received by certain quarters, or who are encouraging people to take a political view, let's say independence, as opposed to celebrating one country concept. PRC.
Can I just step in and say, the other thought that I had when I was listening to what you were saying is that it is important to bring it down to simple concepts and a proper analysis. Apart from anything else, it seems to me that the Timothy Owen, Tim Owen issue has been, it's very inflammatory. People that have commented on it, I won't name the names of the people I have in mind, but they make it sound like it's angry. They're angry about it. It's like, you know, why would we have this? And I don't think that's a service to Hong Kong, to the community, or to the legal system.
Whether LegCo have got a role here, I don't know. But again, if you are doing that, then I think it goes back to a stage just earlier in our discussion. This must be on a principled basis.
Mm.
Why is it that you are saying that Overseas Counsel, in this case, not in complex frauds, whatever it may be, is not to be admitted? Is it because they're not trusted? Is it because they don't have a certain perspective that others have?
Mm-hmm.
What is the rational basis for that? And I think that needs to be examined. And
by the politicians. I mean, because the law's clear enough.
Yes. There's no exemption in the law against who can be. There's simply a provision which is perfectly understandable in Article 63 that you have a statutory duty to maintain confidentiality.
Mm. So it's interesting. It's interesting for the lawyers, at least.
Yes. And of course, that brings us on to another issue. We've talked about counsel. And that is, I think, one of the great strengths of Hong Kong is the quality of the Court of Final Appeal, which is one of the best Supreme Courts, I would say, in the world.
That's quite a compliment to it.
Well, you've got very good standing justices there drawn from Hong Kong. And you've got this wonderful system of an invited non-permanent justice drawn from other Commonwealth countries who come to sit. And in our case, from the UK, it's now former justices of the Supreme Court who've got a lot to contribute. It can be Canada, it can be Australia, it can be New Zealand.
Mm.
And
judges, Hong Kong born and bred, and augmented by the international element.
Well, if you want Hong Kong to be a successful international financial centre, where people are going to come and invest, set up businesses, you have got to have a independent and well-respected legal service. So I think everybody needs to bear that in mind.
Good. Are we optimistic for the future? The future of the profession here?
I think so. I hope that the bar, I hope the non-permanent judges will bear in mind the people of Hong Kong and that
Cantonese. Yes.
So I think we'll have to see what happens there. Whether or not the High Court or Secretary of Justice and others will begin to construe more narrowly the admission of overseas counsel, I don't know. Obviously, we don't have a pink card that entitles us to come here, and nor would we want that. But I think in suitable cases, I hope and believe that we continue to add value, and we very much want to do so.
Well, from a personal perspective and from Haldane's, we would agree wholeheartedly, and let's hope it is a continuing way of administering justice here. Thank you very much indeed for listening to our podcast, and we look forward to inviting you back to the next podcast soon.